In 1971, Dr. Seuss published a book you have almost definitely heard of, The Lorax.
Writer and professor in Chicago, John Wilmes.
Generally regarded as a visionary masterpiece of world-making in children's literature, some predictably called the work out as a didactic, anti-capitalist work of socialist propaganda for its take on the environment's fraught relationship with corporate malfeasance. In 1984, though, came a lesser-known work, mostly forgotten by time, which advanced long-dormant Seussian politics into an ideological expression that proved too rankling for much of the book's audience.
So, John, before I jump into this, I just have to say it's really great to talk to another Chicagoan and just hear those flat A's and that great accent.
I'm glad to provide it.
So, this book that you're talking about, what is this book?
It's called A Butter Battle Book. It's one that I read and really liked as a kid, and that I'm starting to learn just since the publication of this article. A lot of people really enjoyed and loved as a kid, but curiously, even though it was written totally amidst like the boom, the Seussian boom, so to speak, It's not one of those that the memory of which has been sort of reinforced constantly, right? It hasn't been franchised in a big way. It hasn't just really stuck around in the mainstream. And it's about essentially the Cold War. It's basically a Cold War parable, and it has these two competing peoples, the Ukes and the Zooks. Neither of them is necessarily standing for America or standing for the Soviet Union. They're both sort of neutral in that sense. And the only thing that really divides them, as far as the book is concerned, is how they butter their bread. The Ukes butter it in the normal fashion, right? Or the fashion that we consider normal anyway, on top, and then the Zooks butter their bread upside down. And this is a great philosophical divide that leads to an arms race between the two. And there's no mistaking that Seuss wants all of this war-mongering to just look really silly and, you know, morally empty.
Help to provide more and
the Outline World Dispatch.
I mean, like, on the surface, this book sounds, you know, kind of kooky. You know, it's kind of like, it reminds me of how a lot of Disney movies or Pixar movies, like, you would watch it as a kid and you realize a lot of stuff goes over your head. So the main thing I'm curious about is, like, how did a book like this get to market?
Well, basically, Seuss was just so big at this point that he could kind of do whatever he wanted. Like, he completely changed the whole market with children's literature, right? Like, when he was first trying to get in, it was pretty, everything he was doing was pretty considered very weird. Whereas now all these goofy rhyming schemes and wild depictions of childhood imagination and anthropomorphized nonsense creatures, they're the norm now in children's literature. And by the time he gets this book out, he's the god of children's literature, basically. So he could have written almost anything.
So basically he, like, used the leverage of The Cat in the Hat and Green Eggs and Ham to just be like, hey, I'm going to, like, sneak in this really wild idea into children's literature.
Yeah, which he'd previously done with The Lorax. And I think that's maybe less rankling to a lot of the audience. I think we overlook how much the attitude nationally about the environment has changed since that came out in the 1970s. Like, even Richard Nixon, I think, acknowledged that we needed to do something about the impacts that, you know, industry will have on the environment. Whereas now the right side of the political spectrum is very much in denial about that. So this book is attacking nationalism and the military-industrial complex in a way that has never been really okay, according to the powers that be.
So, like, let's actually, like, jump back to The Lorax, just, like, as, like, a quick refresher, because, like, I remember reading it as a kid. But can we, like, quickly go over, like, what was the basis of that book?
Yeah, basically, there's a society of these wonderful bears. Can't remember exactly what they're called, but they have these wonderful trees that are very colorful. They have these very colorful tufts at the top of them, and it's a very sort of perfect little ecosystem. And then along comes a man named the Onceler, who you only see his arm in the whole book slash TV special. And he takes these terrific bushels at the top of the trees and basically industrializes them and makes these things called thneeds, which you don't need. And it's a perfect symbol for just how capitalism creates things that we don't need to perpetuate itself. Mm-hmm. And very the Lorax, subtle. Of course, very subtle, right? And the Lorax is, of course, the voice of reason in this. And I think a big part of why the Butter Battle book maybe doesn't persist is it doesn't have a cute little character to anchor everything around,
right?
In the way that the Lorax was. But he pops out of one of these chopped down colorful trees and says, "What are you doing? You can't do this."
So going back to the Butter Battle book, like, it obviously made like such a big impact and enough where it warranted this revisit in this essay. But like looking back, was it even popular like when it first came out?
Hard for me to say exactly. I was technically not alive when it came out. But it didn't. It definitely never caught on in the way that the Lorax even did, or certainly not in the way as like Cat in the Hat or Green Eggs and Ham. It did get banned in a certain number of places. I don't know exactly why. There isn't like a ton of archivalism on the stories of that, but it probably because it's anti-nationalist, but also I think because it's just sort of unsettling. Mm-hmm. To so bluntly and kind of savagely depict bloated male egos just inching society toward the literal apocalypse. And the book itself ends on a blank white page that could very well be interpreted as the end of all life.
Man, you know, very, very, very light conversations for kids' books.
Yeah, exactly.
So this has me thinking because, like, when I read this piece, I immediately thought of Shel Silverstein, and he kind of had like a similar way in like having these deeper message, sort of disguised as children's books. But you know, since you probably have a deeper knowledge of this than me, is there like any recent examples of creators using children's media to sneak in a deeper message that like we could look out for?
I mean, I think the even just like Pixar movies do that a little bit. Mm-hmm. WALL-E is definitely like a cautionary tale about both the environment and just sort of like cultural slovenliness. And I know I have conservative parents who they won't go see Pixar movies and stuff anymore because they think that it's a bunch of, you know, liberalist propaganda or whatever.
Wow.
So I think that the audience for kids movies that have these leftist messages underneath them is a lot bigger probably than it was when Seuss was trying to push through. But I also think that he has a lot to do with the establishment of that audience and showing sort of creating a blueprint for such a thing.
Hmm. Well, it's definitely going to make my copy of Oh, the Places That You'll Go like seem a lot different, even though I was like gifted that as I graduated.
Yeah, I love that book. Is so wistful and not really like ideological necessarily, right? In such a way that like even Melania Trump can get down with it. She's been like trying to donate that book to libraries to look good or whatever. But yeah, she certainly wouldn't be giving this one out.
Writer and professor in Chicago, John Wilmes. Thanks, John.
Thanks, James.
The Outline World Dispatch is produced and hosted by me, James T. Green. Today's music is courtesy of APM, and our theme is by the fantastic John Lagomarsino. I'm James T. Green, and I leave you with this. "Grandpa," I shouted, "be careful. Oh, gee, who's going to drop it? Will you or will he?" "Be patient," said Grandpa. "We'll see. We will see." See you later.